Hello, today is Friday, May 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, tensions build between the U.S. and Iran. No sign of a trade agreement between China and the U.S. as a Trump-imposed tariff deadline looms.
We've been paying China $500 billion a year for many, many years. China rebuilt their country because of us.
Also ahead, a popular girl group is about to kick off a reunion tour and a vinyl version of their greatest hits. It's all on today's International Edition. China's Vice Premier Li Qiu said he hopes to engage in a rational and candid exchange with the U.S. after arriving in Washington for a new round of trade talks. Liu said raising tariffs is not the solution. He arrived in Washington Thursday with the United States set to impose higher tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods at midnight U.S. Eastern Time on Friday. White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman tells VOA Asia's Ira Melman that President Trump had quite a bit to say to the press about it during an impromptu news conference.
There were quite a few statements that he made. Most significantly, he said, quote, "We're starting that paperwork today," referring to the new, what he called, very heavy tariffs that are due to go into effect on Chinese products coming into the United States from Friday. And the official notice is now out by the Customs and Border Protection Service. So unless something spectacular happens in the next few hours with these trade talks, these tariffs, which will raise from 10% to 25% the cost of importing Chinese goods into this country, about $200 billion worth of products, will go into effect.
As he usually does, the U.S. president made sure that people knew how friendly he was with the Chinese leader.
I like the president a lot. He's a friend of mine. But I'm representing the USA, and he's representing China. And we're not going to be taken advantage of anymore. We're not going to pay China $500 billion a year. So we put very heavy tariffs on China as of Friday, and we put them on also 8 months ago.
So the president mentioning that he had received a beautiful letter, presumably this week, from the Chinese president Xi Jinping, that essentially expressed a sentiment of let's work together. And the president in the past has also spoken glowingly about receiving letters from Kim Jong-un.
Steve, the talks were scheduled to get underway about 5 o'clock. What do you hear is going on now?
Presumably, they are still talking. And not only is President Xi's right-hand man, vice premier, leading the talks for the Chinese delegation, but the U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer are also there. And there's been this shuttling going on between Beijing and Washington for really some months now to try to sort this out. And there were indications that we were getting very close until just a few days ago when the president took to Twitter and said things were not going well, accusing the Chinese essentially of backtracking. Now, Beijing, of course, has a different view and is also threatening retaliation in kind if these tariffs do go into effect.
All right, that is White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman talking to VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. U.S. carriers and bombers arrive in the Middle East to deter Iran. The UN or EU nations are living far beyond the Earth's means. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the White House is obstructing justice every single day. And the New York Senate okays a bill giving the U.S. House access to Trump's state tax returns. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The USS Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier strike group and four B-52 bombers have all arrived in the Middle East region after concerns Iran may be planning an attack against American targets. The carrier strike group completed its transit Thursday through the Suez Canal. President Hassan Rouhani said Iran would enrich uranium beyond allowable limits if the world powers don't protect Iran from the sanctions within 60 days by the U.S. European leaders also say they want to preserve the 2015 agreement, which requires Iran to curb its nuclear program in exchange for the elimination of sanctions. The U.S. abandoned the agreement 1 year ago. Despite the U.S. withdrawal, President Trump introduced new sanctions on Iranian metal exports Wednesday, major sources of revenue for the Western Asian country. The U.S. had previously slapped sanctions on Iranian oil, which have devastated its economy. Joining us now to understand more about it, this escalation in tensions, is Jamil Jaffer, founder and CEO of the National Security Institute. Thanks for being with us. So what does this all mean?
It would not be unusual if the information they had obtained was from a highly sensitive source or method. Oftentimes, the CIA will hold those meetings at their own headquarters. They may bring that information up for the president in a very close setting at the National Security Council. But it also wouldn't be surprising, say, if it were a particularly sensitive human source, a very sensitive technical capability, a very sensitive sort of overhead surveillance methodology. There might be a number of reasons why you might have information limited to a very small group of people and have it only given in a very unique setting. So that may be part of what's going on here.
And in general, generally speaking, Iran is now threatening more Iranian enrichment. We weren't seeing any activity before the U.S. pulled out of the Iran deal. It seems like tensions are really building. Why do you think this is happening now?
Well, certainly the Iranians are feeling an additional pinch as the U.S. sanctions go back into effect. If you recall, one of the reasons that the Iranians came to the table in the Obama administration and negotiated the Iran deal because Congress had imposed very, very strict sanctions on the Iranians, including cutting them off essentially from the world community, both in terms of their supply of oil, their ability to sell oil, but also their ability to transact with most of the world's nations. And so those sanctions have now gone back into effect. And so that's having a pinch on the Iranian economy. Even just in the past couple of days, the U.S. administration has continued to impose additional sanctions on Iran. And so they're feeling the economic pinch. And so they're not seeing some of the benefits the Iran deal. And so their sort of view is, well, maybe we should go back to enriching and maybe that will drive the Europeans to push the Americans back to the table to negotiate again. But I think what you're seeing is actually what was expected and what was intended by the Trump administration, which is the Iranians would get upset and then it would force them back to the table in order to get a better deal than what President Obama got. So that's the working theory of the administration. So what we're seeing here actually isn't surprising. The Iranians getting aggressive and upset. That's what the administration intended. The goal is to drive the Iranians back to the point of maximum pressure and then back to the table to get a better deal for the administration.
Do you think, though, that there may be an intention of some speculate that the U.S. wants to go to war with Iran, that the U.S., because John Bolton in past times has suggested that he would like to see regime change, he's advocated for it for a long time?
I don't think that the U.S. is looking to get into a war in Iran. The Iranians have been very aggressive. They are the ones who decided to seek a nuclear capability. They did so covertly in the Obama administration that was discovered. They are the ones who have been meddling in Syria, in Yemen. They're the ones who continue to support a terrorist group in the form of Hezbollah. And so the Iranians are in this position and have sanctions on them because of their own behavior, both in the region, in support of terrorist groups, and their pursuit of a nuclear capability. And so where Iran to become a normal functioning nation and a world community nation, stop supporting Hezbollah, stop meddling in various parts of the region, and stop pursuing nuclear weapons, well, then there would be no problem with them tomorrow joining the world community of nations becoming and returning to normalcy. And I don't think the U.S. is looking to get in a war. I think at least the administration believes, I think rightly so, that the deal that was made in the prior administration was not as beneficial to the United States as they may have thought. And the question is just how you get to a new deal or a better deal. And this administration, I think, again, correctly assesses that the right way to do it is return to maximum pressure on Iran. So we're now seeing the outcome of that. But I think this is what was expected.
That is Jamil Jaffer, founder and CEO of the National Security Institute. North Korea fired what appeared to be two short-range missiles on Thursday. It's the second such test in less than a week. The United States also says it seized a North Korean cargo ship as tensions again mount between these two countries. President Trump said nobody is happy at the launches, but still appears to be holding the door open for more talks with North Korea.
The relationship continues, but we'll see what happens. I know they want to negotiate. They're talking about negotiating, but I don't think they're ready to negotiate.
South Korea said the tests were worrisome and unhelpful and likely a protest against Trump refusing to ease economic sanctions on North Korea at a failed summit in Hanoi in February. The U.S. has given no sign of willingness to budge on sanctions. And on Thursday, the U.S. Justice Department announced the seizure of that cargo vessel that it said was involved in the illicit shipping of coal. Joining us to talk more about it is Matthew Ha, a research associate at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. What's your take on all of it?
Two separate short-range missile tests coming from two different parts of North Korea. The way I just sort of assessed it is that, you know, North Korea is kind of going back to its sort of way of doing diplomacy, using coercive bargaining and brinkmanship to use sort of these peacetime provocations where it's in that ambiguous space of like a wartime attack, but like it's not enough to like, you know, obviously warrant sort of a retaliatory effect, really to signal that, you know, Kim Jong-un's discontent with the way diplomacy has been going. Because I think after Hanoi, we kind of saw, you know, the failure in his objective to get sanctions lifted. And so I think it's just his way of like nudging President Trump. You should do something to, you know, make it possible.
Certainly the president seems willing to have open talks. He says the relationship continues. He doesn't think Kim would do something that would be detrimental to that. But there is speculation that maybe the president has a little bit too much faith in the integrity of the leader of North Korea.
If I'm correct about the statement you're referring to that President Trump said, I do think there has been some degree of a little over-optimism in the president in the sense that I haven't seen a clear indication that Kim Jong-un has even made the strategic choice to give up his nuclear weapons yet. A lot of other North Korea analysts are on that same page. But at the same time, statements were a bit more, when I say he, I'm referring to President Trump, is that they were a bit more careful because he also did say he's not sure if he's ready to negotiate yet, if Kim's ready to negotiate. And I think he did say he's carefully looking at what happened with the weapons test in the last 5 days, because after over 15, 16, 17 months of no testing, this is, I'll be going back to this fire and fury of 2017. I hope not for sure, but I do think he is a bit more wary now that there was another test in less than a week. So I think we kind of need to see it step by step, and I think there's a bit more time that we need to take before we make any assessment.
Sounds like South Korea is concerned about it.
The Blue House, the equivalent of the White House in South Korea, they did mention that this is a violation of the inter-Korean military agreement from last September, but then President Moon also said something else where he just, it's a concern that the North Koreans are testing missiles or short-range projectiles, as they termed it, but at the same time they avoided using the term provocation.
Do you think it's been detrimental that there's been sort of a normalization of Kim with all these leaders being willing to meet with him when he's still leading a country very brutally?
Yeah, I mean, I think there definitely is a degree of that. I think a lot of us in the analyst community have deemed it as like a smile diplomacy or a charm offensive campaign where he really is trying to appear as this modern leader, like this normal, I'm ahead of the state. I'm head of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. So I think, yes, there is a degree to it because, you know, public opinion of him in South Korea drastically changed after the first inter-Korean summit last April. But I think counterbalance that's normalizing effect, we need President Trump, we need President Moon to really hold Kim Jong-un accountable on his human rights violations, all the atrocities that his government commits. We haven't really seen that in action, and I think we've seen even a reversal of that. Prior to the summit starting in early, mid 2018 last year, is we saw President Trump aggressively attacking Kim on his human rights abuses, but we did see him sort of backpedaling on that maybe right after the Singapore, I believe the Hanoi summit, when he made comments about the warm beer. That was a critical step backward. We must be cognizant. President Trump says he's a bright economic future for North Korea. We also need to see a bright future where human rights are respected in this country. And I think that's a major priority that needs to be brought up, both between the U.S. and North Korea, and most importantly, between the two Koreas themselves.
Amid the missile firing, we are also hearing about the U.S. seizing a North Korean cargo ship that apparently was in violation of illicit shipping. What do you know about this?
We need to go back about a year to assess where this began. The Indonesian government detained a North Korean flag vessel called the Wise Honest that was carrying coal. I believe that was coming from Vladivostok in Russia. And it was in violation of UN sanctions against coal. But this vessel was owned by a company that was already sanctioned by the United States Treasury Department for evading other sanctions with North Korea sort of related things. And so this was the U.S. government's way of sending a very strong signal to Kim, in the sense that if Kim really wants sanctions lifted, we're not going to give it to you just because you're going to fire a missile and say, I'm unhappy. We can only respect the integrity of sanctions by seeing you comply to them, and then we can lift them. And until then, until we see North Korea sort of complying to those terms and also showing that it has the strategic intent to denuclearize, we're going to keep enforcing sanctions and withholding pressure until we see that change happening. This ultimately reveals that President Trump, the one difference that he does have many of his predecessors, is a robust sanctions regime that really has been a byproduct of legislation such as the North Korea Sanctions and Policy Enhancement Act passed in 2016 and just the numerous executive orders that came out in between then and now.
All right, that's Matthew Ha, Research Associate at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. President Donald Trump's approval rating in the latest Gallup poll is up to 46%, the highest it has been in that poll since the earliest days of his presidency. Some Republicans say the time is right for the president to move on from the aftermath of the Russia probe led by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. But it seems neither Trump nor his Democratic critics are in any hurry to let the issue go, as we hear from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
Please welcome the President of the United States.
On the campaign trail in Florida, President Trump made sure to remind his supporters about the outcome of the Mueller report.
Did you see what just happened, by the way? No collusion, no obstruction, no anything. They want to do what they're doing, which looks so foolish. And maybe I read it wrong, but I think it drives us right on to victory in 2020, because people get it. People get it.
The report found no criminal conspiracy between the Trump campaign and Russia to meddle in the 2016 election. Mueller did not reach a conclusion on the issue of obstruction of justice, but he pointedly did not exonerate the president either, a claim Trump often makes. Republicans say it's time to move on, including Senate leader Mitch McConnell.
It's over. I mean, I can understand why our friends on the other side are disappointed. They've been trying to look for some way to overturn the 2016 election for two long years.
Judiciary Committee will please come to order.
Congressional Democrats have vowed to keep the pressure on with hearings and investigations. They're also moving towards citing Attorney General William Barr with contempt of Congress for not producing an unredacted version of the Mueller report. House Democrat Jerry Nadler.
They are stonewalling the American people from all information, and this cannot be.
However, Democrats remain divided over whether to pursue Trump's impeachment, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Impeachment is one of the most divisive and dividing paths that you can take. And if you go down that path, you have to have a prospect for success.
Republicans control the Senate, making any Democratic impeachment bid a long shot, says expert David Abraham.
An impeachment proceeding that enjoys zero Republican support will be effectively portrayed in the presidential election as more or less witch hunt by sore losers.
As a political issue, the Russia investigation appears far from over and will be part of next year's presidential campaign debate, says John Fortier.
Democrats are very unhappy with the president. Many Republicans are very happy with him. And so that is a formula for enthusiasm. Even though it may not be a pretty sight, it's likely that we're going to see people wanting to turn out in this next election.
We've never been winning like we're winning now.
Despite the furor over the Russia investigation, Trump's poll numbers have remained stable, says analyst Matt Dalek.
His ceiling is pretty low, you know, around 44% of the public. He's never cracked 50%. First times in the history of polling that no president has ever gone above 50% approval. But his floor is also pretty solid, pretty hard. He's rarely gone below 36%.
Trump will continue to proclaim vindication, and Democrats will persevere with their oversight hearings. But it's U.S. voters who are likely to deliver the final verdict in November of 2020.
And we will make America great again.
Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The 2019 VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture U.S. byways. including beautiful photos of the Big Sur Coast Highway and even the historic Route 66. Tune in to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal to request a free calendar.
VOA's International Edition continues. The United Nations released a new global report on the environment this week. It says the decline of nature is unprecedented and species extinction is accelerating. The study warns that many factors are having a severe impact, including climate change, pollution, deforestation, and invasive plants and animals. In South Africa, the Garden Route National Park is located along one of the country's most beautiful stretches of coastline. It's also a place where a large number of invasive plants have taken over. VOA's Deborah Block takes us there to find out how officials are working to keep them at bay.
South Africa's Garden Route National Park offers visitors lush forests and a dramatic coastline. But the biodiversity of the 650 square kilometer park is under threat from invasive species.
The number one threat in the Garden National Park for biodiversity at this point is alien species, alien plant species. We have a diversity of species, about 200 alien species, but only about 10 or 15 to 20 maybe are transformer species that really can change your area.
The invasive plants compete with the scrub and trees that are endemic to the area. Wildfires in 2017 and 18 damaged much of the forest. But the destruction made it easier for park rangers to identify and eradicate invasive species.
Fire also affords one the opportunity to be able to walk into the area because there are less indigenous vegetation immediately behind it. Your alien plants grow faster than indigenous, so you see them in the first 2 or 3 years. So you have that window of opportunity where you have to kill them before they make seed. If you can do that, then you gained a lot from having the fire.
What is key is to ensure that there are follow-up control measures that are put in place so that if there had been a fire, then you actually control the regrowth of invasive alien species after the fire.
New indigenous species are still being found in the park.
There's a sense of awe and wonder still in a lot of these tucked away places. And at the same time, there's species of plants that seem to disappear for long periods of time and, you know, are considered extinct. And then after extreme events, they actually resurface.
Keeping the biodiversity for visitors to enjoy for years to come. Deborah Block, VOA News.
Robert Kyagulani, the Ugandan singer and legislator better known as Bobi Wine, has vowed to continue using music to denounce longtime President Yoweri Museveni. But as Halima Athumani reports from Kampala, his music is now facing stiff control from the state.
We are fighting for freedom. Yo! We are living in a time similar to the one of slave trade. This operation is worse than apartheid.
Bobi Wine has been singing and entertaining Ugandans since he was a teenager. Now 37 and a member of parliament, his songs today carry a political message. Wine, whose real name is Robert Kyagulanyi, says it's time for the country's young people to awaken and challenge President Museveni.
Our message has been primarily a message of mental emancipation, of knowing that Ugandans are actually the owners of this country and the leaders must do everything they do in the benefit of the people, which is not the case here today.
It's rare that Wine gets to sing these days. Since 2017, more than 120 planned of his concerts have been cancelled by the police, who says his management failed to meet minimum security standards required to host revelers. To stop his concerts, police have used arrests and tear gas to clear the crowds. Wine supporters, such as Chifampa Nsambu, are not happy.
He's singing about the Ugandan who is suffering, and he's talking about the riot on ground. Those who are living in posh houses and posh cars, moving in SC cars, they do not feel the situation that is happening here. But it is the government that is destroying the peace that is here.
Under house arrest, the musician once again turned to his music to send a message to the police.
You're breaking my hand, officer. I'm not fighting you, my brother. Why are you hurting me?
Why beat me? I'm missing out of out in our way. Why kick me?
His message, I am fighting for you. I'm not against you. Days later, he was arrested again on charges of unlawfully engaging in a protest against Uganda's 2018 social media tax. He was released on bail. Political analyst Miriam Matembe says the message of Bobi Wine's music helped get him elected to the legislature.
They elected him because they believe in what he stands for. Now, why should you brutalize him, torture him, simply because you fear that he's threatening your position as the president of Uganda.
Solomon Sirwanyi, deputy chief whip of the ruling National Resistance Movement Party, says he does not have a problem with Wine as long as he can differentiate between music and politics.
Of course, as a musician, I support Bobi Wine so much. I love the music, I support his music. But as a president of Uganda, of course, I don't support him. I support President Museveni because I believe he still has a vision for this country.
During the 2011 election campaign, President Museveni's team created a song of a rhyme he made during a speech.
Today, these young people talked to me about this rap because I was not following what they were saying. Do you want another rap?
We are the youngest population in the world. We stand a chance. We are the leaders of the future, and the future is today.
Museveni isn't competing with Bobi Wine on music stage, but he will have to test his popularity next to Museveni in the political arena if the legislator decides to run for president in 2021. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
The Spice Girls are going retro. The British girl group is re-releasing their greatest hits album on vinyl. They made the announcement this week ahead of a reunion tour. The album includes photos with the group, which the group shared on Instagram, that includes the singers throughout the years of their performances. The greatest hits, originally in 2007, features 15 songs. The Spice Greatest Hits vinyl album will be released on May 31st, but only for a limited time. The Spice Girls' Spice World reunion tour kicks off in Dublin, Ireland, at the end of the month. You gotta take it easy, throwing far too much emotions at me. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
This is VOA.